Welcome to an all new episode of the McFuture podcast. I'm Steve Factor. Today I'm going to do something a little bit different. I'm going to play you some highlights from recent episodes of Mistweeted that were only on Patreon for subscribers. And don't worry, if you're a subscriber, there's plenty of original content. I'm not putting everything out there, just a few interesting segments that hopefully you'll A, enjoy, and B, will inspire you to subscribe to patreon.com/McFuture. Anyway, here they go. And I'm just going to separate them out with like a little tone so you know I'm switching subjects. David Graeber, I think he was the one who wrote the book Bullshit Jobs, which, by the way, I've also written about before him. I want credit. Give me credit. I want credit. Anyway, so he tweeted, all the publishers that he knows blame Jeff Bezos and Amazon for the destruction of the book industry. And someone who has had a book published by a major publisher and has dealt with a bunch of different publishers on the way to doing that, it's much more complicated than just blaming Amazon. First, nobody reads. I found a whole bunch of stats that I'm not going to get into, but leisure time reading has plummeted. And what that did was make publishing a shrinking industry. They have consolidation. They shed a lot of jobs, a lot of companies go out of business, other competitors go in and they take share, they hire some of the best people. You're left with this shrunken shell of a former industry. And secondly, publishers, they're stuck in some sort of legendary status that they don't have anymore. They have a lore of, you know, of greatness. That lore is now crippling them. If I told you about some of the insane conversations I had, I'll tell you about one. There was a woman that I was introduced to, I guess she was a VP at some big publisher at the time. We got on the phone and her first question was, well, how did we get introduced? So I told her who the person was. And she's like, well, you know, this is so unusual because normally I get introduced through an agent. And, you know, and then she started lecturing me about the process. And I looked at the time. We were 10 minutes into our phone call. She was consumed with how the process is supposed to work. And at some point, I just said, well, we're on the phone now. Maybe we should talk about the book a little bit. She did not care about the actual content. She cared more about the process. My brain melted and oozed out of my ears. I just couldn't believe someone that senior can function in this way. It told me everything I needed to know about this business. Digital was their extinction event, not Amazon. This transition to ebooks and user experience and new business models and the death of exclusivity and of gatekeepers who get to decide what gets published and what doesn't, and all these new marketing channels and tools, they were prepared for exactly 0% of this. They just didn't have the vision for this market. They didn't have the skills. So to think that this corporate paraplegia can rush into battle and defeat, you know, the monster that is Amazon is insanity to me. It's insanity. And to blame Amazon is a lazy way to think about this. Authors, they were just as complicit in this. When anyone can publish, and there are countless new modes of consumption, you got to raise your game. Just because you're an author and you wrote something, that doesn't entitle you to getting published, doesn't entitle you to getting your voice heard, doesn't entitle you to making money. It just doesn't. And unless you raise your game to the level that others are doing it or adopt some of these new technologies and marketing techniques, you're screwed. And you're dealing with a shrinking business and shrinking amount of consumption time and more people publishing because the tools are readily available. The competition level is through the roof. So you better be interesting. You better be more interesting than now, instead of 100 people that are submitting book proposals, 100,000 people that could just type one up and self-publish. And finally, you know, when they realized they were losing power, the publishers sued. They sued Amazon. And Amazon did some shady things, so I don't want to pretend like they didn't. But that's what uncreative incumbents do. They follow this well-worn path. It's the same path that Kodak took and Blockbuster took. And they're essentially, you know, realizing that they're tumbling downward and they're just trying to grasp to, you know, little rocks and things that could keep them from, you know, hitting the bottom of the trench. And authors have to keep up. And maybe you're not an author anymore. Maybe you need to think of yourself as a creator of some kind and find ways of telling stories that people actually want. And same thing happened with bookstores. You know, if you sell a commodity like a book that's readily available online and also downloadable online with zero waiting time, you better raise your game. And, you know, I tweeted this before COVID, but even now, you know, this is going to come around. People are going to want to get out and participate in life again. They're not going to be locked up forever. So hosting book clubs, author readings, experiences for kids, literary debates and competitions, debate championships with betting. You could have cosplay costume competitions of your favorite literary characters. You can have movie versus book night, where you screen a movie and then people debate which was better, the movie or the book. Monthly subscription book club. Promote customers' work. Have readings of their work and feature them in your bookstore. I could do this all day. I can make hundreds of these ideas, hundreds. And to not adopt any of them and then point to Amazon and say, oh, they're taking our business, you are lazy. I'm sorry, you are lazy. And yes, sometimes it hits you hard, but that's when you have to get creative or shut down, regroup, and come back as something else, something that people actually want. And yes, you should fight back against predatory companies. But at some point, you also have to innovate. You just have to. Markets change. They always do. And there are ways to do it better. You know, it's funny. We were talking about books. Barnes & Noble in 1995, you know, when Windows came out, was a place people could go for tech support with Windows 95. And if you had Windows 95, you needed tech support. You needed more tech support than anyone in the history of the world has ever needed. More tech support than RoboCop, more tech support than the Terminator. I'm talking about insane amounts because that thing would crash every 5 seconds. But I actually think they were onto something. I still think there is a huge opportunity for a digital support center, because technology is getting more pervasive and more complex. A lot of people are getting older. Some people are just not wired for it. And there's just this big unmet need for people to learn how to use everyday technology. Some sort of helpline, in-home servicing, and at some point after COVID, retail locations. Geek Squad that kind of did some of that, which was acquired by Best Buy. You have the Apple Store and Genius Bar, but really they're in the business of selling you new stuff. They're in the business of you showing them a device, they look it over, try to turn it on, go, oh no, you need a new one. Well, I do think there is room for an entity that cares, and Barnes & Noble, ironically, was onto it, but these are different times, I guess. A while back, I tweeted, soon there'll be one celebrity for every civilian and one career coach for every worker. We're not gonna need that many people working, but all the people are like, oh, we gotta go do yoga. I'm a yoga instructor now. Did you know I got certified? And then the future arrived. There was a video that was posted of a house of TikTokers who are preparing exactly for this future. And I'm gonna play this clip. It's amazing.
Here's what goes on at our adult TikTok house called the Honey House.
Sam is filming workouts for her YouTube channel, and her team is here shooting it. Nick works for a big time agency, and so he's always talking to brands and helping them with their marketing. B is a mindset and meditation coach, so she's always leading guided meditations on her computer.
Erin is an e-com wizard, and so she consults and advises a lot of Better For You brands, so she's always sitting here on her computer crushing it.
Jared's a fitness trainer and he's also an actor, so if he's not reading his sides, he's working out and he's probably eating. Nick is a mindset and motivation coach, and so he's always firing people up on the phone.
Evan and Dina are models and fitness trainers, and if they're not doing a photo shoot, they're working out.
And then there's me.
Isn't that unreal? Like, the future has arrived, or at least the future as I saw it. I started to think about how bad we are at self-assessment and self-awareness, especially when it comes to our blind spots. And we all have them. There are things that we're just not wired for. Some people aren't wired for technology. Some people are more mathematically minded. Others are more literary. And some are detail-oriented and some are big picture. To be successful in life, it's very important to augment the thing that you're great at with someone who complements that weakness. It's very hard. I know I'm kind of a big picture person, but I also force myself to do a lot of detail stuff like this. Like setting up these videos is torture for me because you have to make sure every little thing, every little box is ticked. It's a muscle that you can learn to develop or you could augment with others. But you look at professions like economics, for example. The reason I think economics is struggling as a profession, and maybe economists won't agree with it, but I don't care, they don't have a good grasp of technology or culture trends. Economics is inseparable from culture. There's a professor of economics who won a Nobel Prize, I think it was last year, Richard Thaler is his name. He showed that a lot of the things economists expect people to do that are rational, they don't do. Economics is very much a social science. I know it has some numbers and some other things that make it look, you know, more sciencey, like hard science, like physics or biology, but it's not. It's very much tied to culture. What you observe here in the US is not going to be the behavior you observe some other country or even in a different period in time. You fast forward to the future or to the past, people were different. They won't react the same way. COVID, for example, is a big shift in how people think, and that will have a cascading effect through their behaviors. The same thing happened after 9/11, how people think was affected. In fact, they were for the first time even acknowledging the existence of the Middle East, for better or worse. Also, technologists are people who tend to think rationally in ways that people do not. And they're a bunch of doers, like people who make great product. I think I make really good, compelling content. I make really good things, but I'm very bad at publicizing them. And I don't have the ego for it. And it's funny because when you put stuff out there, you would think that ego is one of the reasons you want some sort of acknowledgement and adulation. I think that's part of it, but for me, a very small part. I think for me, it's always been about expressing creativity more than anything else. And for a lot of people who are creatives and creators, it's very hard to put themselves into marketing mode. And so they need to almost force themselves to dedicate a percentage of their time to putting their work out there, not just creating more work. And I think there is something to be said for lots of quality work eventually being recognized, but there's also something to be said for going the way of Van Gogh, slicing your ear off and killing yourself. So, you know, so yeah, great creators can go any number of ways. So I think marketing can be salvation for a lot of great creators. And quite frankly, it's been salvation for a lot of mediocre creators, because a lot of times the people who just kept putting stuff out and kept marketing themselves did better than a lot of people that I know have more talent, but maybe just gave up because they never seemed to get the traction. And the other kinds of people that have blind spots, the world is filled up with them. People who have low information or no information about a lot of topics, still giving their opinions on those topics. And I see it all the time. I mean, we arguably have a president and a bunch of Congress people who do that regularly. The blind are leading the blind. You can never be fully informed on every single issue. Sometimes you need to act with limited information, but there is attainable knowledge out there that people just aren't attaining. I watched Elon Musk's Neuralink video. And in case you don't know what a Neuralink is, it's basically bullshit. I mean, it's a great forward-thinking, futuristic technology where they drill a hole in your skull and implant this device. It's supposed to read your brain waves. It's supposed to help people who have certain brain disorders and disabilities. And at some point, it should help people who are paralyzed send brain waves to the rest of the body, wherever the, you know, paralysis happened. So listen, I clearly I'm not the right person to explain the medical science here, but they did this on several pigs that they drilled the holes in, and they had one pig that they took it out of. What a horrible waste of pigs. I mean, you know, I'd rather have bacon than some disfigured pig. And they showed this machine that's used to do this drilling that I can't imagine anyone signing up to do this. But then again, there are people signing up to go to Mars. So you never know. There's a lot of people with no purpose in their lives and who would otherwise walk in front of a bus, and they're like, okay, well, you know what? Maybe you should drill something into my head. And maybe we should as a society, just because what is the alternate use for a person who feels there's no purpose for them? What we see is this inkling of a future where biology and technology start to meld, and people call it cyborg or whatever. Once they do, that's the unification point between biological and physiological malware and viruses and diseases. So what was once something that could infect only computers can now jump into the computer that is your brain and into our biology. So we're opening the door to hacking. And if AI ever becomes self-aware or something that sci-fi movies have predicted, it will wipe us out. The other thing that was funny is this thing uses Bluetooth. The other day I was trimming my sideburns and I have this electric razor, but I was also wearing my Bluetooth headset. And whenever the razor got close to the sideburn, the Bluetooth would cut out. Now, this is in your brain. So your brain is now relying on a technology that can't keep a Bluetooth headset connected. You know, so we're going to see people who, I'm cured. I used to be a paraplegic. I can walk. And then they walk by like, you know, some, you know, electrical outlet, and then they just collapse. I mean, it is kind of insane that we have to rely on these rudimentary technologies. And it's shorthand to say we're not there yet. I'm not sure that Neuralink will be around for that, because no one's going to invest in a startup where the payback is 10 years from now. And that's where governments should come in. But our government has been remiss in doing that for decades now. To be fair, SpaceX did do that successfully. They had a lot of funding from NASA and government. So it can be done through these private-public partnerships. It is something that shows promise, but also kind of reveals a certain dark side to our future. Personally, I'm saving my Neuralink implant for when I'm 80. The list so far includes psychedelics, skydiving, pimping, vigilantism, owning a pit bull, base jumping, you know, like in those wingsuits where you jump off the cliff, gangster rapping. I want to have beef with whoever the young punk gangster rapper is at the time. But of course, the new gangster rappers are so soft and nice. Next guy's going to be, yo, I'm in vegan. And I'm going to be like, yo, I'm a meat eater. By the way, my final raps are going to be much better. I'm going to practice a lot when I'm 79. And fathering a litter of kids that I can identify in the Maury Povich show. A lot to look forward to. A lot of people were worried that movie theaters are going to close because of COVID. I'm not that worried, because the biggest movie chain ever, AMC, the biggest one in the US, is owned by a Chinese company. And there is no way in hell that the Chinese are going to let these guys go out of business. Never in a million years. Because they're going to float them unlimited money. Unlimited. Because they want to retain distribution leverage in Hollywood. Because remember, it's in China's interest to create propaganda. And Hollywood is in the business of creating propaganda for China. How does that happen? Because China is a growing market for consuming Hollywood movies and TV shows and other products, they've been gaining leverage to make sure China is shown in a positive light, that there are more Chinese actors and Chinese heroes in these stories. And on the surface, you know, hey, nothing bad about that. Why shouldn't, you know, Chinese people be well represented? But this is part of the game. This is part of the propaganda engine that goes on in communist countries. I know a lot about communism. In fact, I'm going to do a whole episode about this coming up. But you cannot underestimate the importance of perpetual bombardment of ideas, because it changes, especially subconsciously, changes how people think. And there's story after story of China exerting leverage. And AMC is a component of their leverage. Make no mistake about it. So somehow sleep became a thing. People are talking about sleep all the time. Arianna Huffington, of all people, this cracks me up. She made a fortune off of other people's labor, you know, because all of them were pretty much free contributors. And now she has dedicated her life to sleep. So she talks about nothing but sleep. Everyone should sleep. Meanwhile, I bet you she did not sleep very much working her way towards the top or towards her 300 million. So it's kind of ironic and disingenuous with all these rich people with tons of spare time in their hands and personal trainers and gurus and time to meditate and all these amazing things preaching to you how you really need to sleep. You really need to dedicate some time to this, learning about the subject, studying the subject. Anyway, so there's a Time Magazine article, 5 ways to get the most from your sleep. You'll have to look up Time Magazine's 5. So here are my 5. Number 1, charge for it. There's at least one lonely weirdo freak who'll pay to watch you sleep. He's harmless, don't worry. Maybe even, you know, for a little extra money, let him curl up at the foot of your bed. Not in bed, because that would be super weird. But just at the foot of your bed, that would be kind of nice, you know? And you get paid for it. Number 2, set random alarms so you can wake up mid-dream, have your intern there to transcribe those dreams and make them into Hollywood blockbusters. Number 3, play Chinese lessons while you sleep to prep your subconscious for America's collapse and China's takeover. Number 4, meditate before you sleep. So just start chanting items that you need from Nordstrom, and when you wake up, your conscious mind will manifest them when you awake. So it's sort of like the secret, but retail. It's like the retail secret. God, I want to be the next Oprah so badly. Have I mentioned that before? And number 5, learn to sleepwalk. Just train that idiot who's sleepwalking to do all of your dumb PowerPoints, and then you wake up refreshed, work is done, vamos a la playa. I love this. At first, I saw this. I'm like, oh my God, what a ridiculous thing. They're so out of ideas. The headline was, Fresh Prince of Bel-Air drama reboot lands at Peacock, which is NBC's streaming network, with a 2-season order. And Will Smith, Benny Medina, and Quincy Jones are involved in making it. So they already have 2 seasons that were purchased. I'm like, oh my God, are we so out of ideas that we have to dredge up a series from the 80s? And then I looked a little bit further and read the article. Turns out there's a guy who did a trailer for a reboot, this young guy, this young black guy, and it was such a great trailer, as good as any dramatic trailer for a TV show or movie. I've written about this in my book, In a Conversation. I talked about auditioning. It's exactly what it sounds like, putting out there what you want to do, and if it's great, people will come to you. And the example I used in the book, Google came up with this feature where you start typing into the search box and it starts auto-filling and showing you the search results before you even press enter. So this kid, he developed the same exact thing for YouTube on his own. He put it out there, and YouTube, the person who was running it at the time, basically reached out to him and says, hey, you don't have to go to college anymore. You have a job here. And I don't know exactly if he took the job or what, but this is how you can do it. And I have countless examples that I'm tweeting about. And this is something everyone should do. Make yourself undeniable. Listen, I'm doing this now. For all I know, I'm auditioning for some network that eventually is going to fire me and a mob to cancel me. But regardless, put it out there. And another guy I follow, he's a startup guy. I don't know his last name, but his first name is Sahil. What he wrote was, research the company, use the product, find the CEO's email online, which is super easy to do, write a personable and a very specific email that relays your experience and suggest some ideas or report a bug or include a small user experience improvement. So if you come up with something tangible and you reach out to the CEO, they're going to consider you. Look, you may not, they may not make you a senior vice president the first day, but they're going to seriously look at you for a position that's appropriate for your level, and you have an in. This is part of auditioning. This is how you do it. And this is coming from a guy who's been a CEO of a startup. And I'm a person who's hired tons of people. And if someone did that to me, you can bet that I would seriously consider them. Absolutely. I don't care if the other candidate is from Harvard and has all these, you know, McKinsey experience, all this other stuff. I will take the practical, smart, motivated person every single time. Every time. And speaking of the future, a guy I follow, he's a startup guy, this guy Balaji. He really says, look, what is the successor to America or to any country? And what he thinks is, you know, as we move on to virtual reality and using virtual currencies, that digital is more a better metaphor for countries than physical countries. And that's where, you know, people should agree on mutual rules and governance and crowdfund the things that are important in cities. And you can also get land with a bunch of like-minded people. And this entire process can be negotiated with a host government where you can live by your own rules of that community that you formed from those interests. I think that's interesting, and I think that's possible. But I also think there's going to be a lot of friction on that trajectory. And the three sources of friction are, one, incumbents aren't just going to let this happen. And I'm talking about countries, companies, and, you know, rich people, powerful people. There's going to be incredible pushback because they benefit from status quo. They benefit from the way things work. And can you imagine, you know, you don't have to imagine it. You know, the US government didn't allow Bitcoin to subvert our currency or just to run amok. They started regulating it. They started taxing it. They started tracking it because they know that control of the dollar is essential to the US survival, really. Because, you know, if we were in the same boat other countries were in, we'd be screwed. Just our ability to print dollars and the fact that every other country does their business in dollars keeps us afloat as a country and almost allows us to run unlimited, not quite unlimited debt, but that's what we're doing when we're doing all these relief packages of trillions of dollars. And, you know, I think the other impediment is going to be this backlash against technological chaos and control. And it's some of the things that I've spoken about before, which is, you know, we're giving up a lot of power to these corporations that are largely unaccountable to us. We don't know what they're doing with our data. We don't know how we will even log back in if we get locked out, or how we'll communicate with our customers or whatever if we get banned or canceled or whatever it is. So I think there is a backlash brewing. It's hard to know how strong it is because I think most people just go along, use their technology and not make a stink about it. They have other problems. But also the third thing, which is the fundamental weakness of digital bonds. Digital bonds are weak. So are people going to move just because they have some things in common with a bunch of people who, you know, want to start some, you know, libertarian government that runs on Bitcoin, or some other people that are super into cosplay and they want to create a country inside of Montana? You know, I don't think those connections run that deep, not the same way that traditional communities used to, or ones that are built on families and then extended clans that still exist in other places in India, although these things are weakening over time as well. There's also a chance that we're overcorrecting. You know, so you see these trends about working from home, suburbanization, killing retail, home entertainment, contact tracing, and, you know, invading people's privacy to do it, infection paranoia. all of these things might be huge overcorrections, very similar to the surveillance state after 9/11 and all the paranoia that followed it about Middle East and so on. And some of it justified, a lot of it not justified. It's okay if these overreactions are on an individual level or even on a corporate level, because there are ways that the market forces you to adjust very quickly. You know, it forces you as a company, because if you're not making money based on a world of overreactions, you adjust in order to make the money. Individual, same thing. If you can't get a job remotely, you're going to move back to where the jobs are and maybe to a city. So we have the capacity to be much more fluid than government. What worries me is we're going to take a lot of these projections and these overcorrections and freeze them and calcify them in our laws, in which case they start to distort our economy and our behavior in the same way that, you know, the surveillance state started distorting what we do at airports. So I think it's okay to underreact in some cases, especially for government, because individuals and corporations are much more flexible in reacting. And so even if government does get involved, I'd be very cautious about the degree of permanence to any of their actions. We see a tidal wave of small business closures. In fact, 75,000 of the businesses that are on Yelp have permanently shut down. 15,000 of those were restaurants. I also don't know how much propping up of these businesses makes sense. And it's not that I don't want to support them. I think it's really important to keep small businesses afloat. My concern is that so much is going to change about the composition of cities, where people live, where people move, and the patterns of behavior, that the businesses that existed before may not exist in the future. There just might not be a market for them. I think retailers are an obvious thing because there was barely a market for them before, and this was just the final straw. But I think in terms of dining out, in terms of anything that's experiential, you know, laser tag place or something like that, I think people are going to think twice about doing some of those things. And I don't know that their market is going to come back in time for any kind of funding to last them. So I think we need to be a little bit more judicious, because I think we're in a very scary place economically, where our debt is now bigger than our GDP. We're getting older as a society, and unless we have some sort of growth engine that I'm not aware of, or some innovations coming that are going to be exclusively American, we're going to have a tough time repaying it and holding rates down enough to have money available for other things. Because remember, the bigger your debt, the bigger your interest payments, and the less money you have available for other things, for other investments. I talked about R&D earlier. Well, how are you going to fund all these things if you're paying off debt? And for now, we're able to keep rates low. There's no guarantee we're going to be able to do that in the future or forever. So I wanted to have a little fun to celebrate Bernie Sanders' birthday. Bernie, of course, you know, led a movement, a revolution, some might say, he would say. And he's actually been very influential, and I give him a lot of crap. And, you know, look, I like to have fun with Bernie, although Bernie does not seem like a lot of fun, because he'd always be yelling and his hair would be, the millionaires and the billionaires. He stopped saying millionaires because he became a millionaire. So the billionaires are destroying our country. Anyway. So how did I celebrate Bernie's birthday? Well, first, I ate 3 bags of organic kale chips at Whole Foods and never paid for them. I also honked the Russian national anthem at people in Mercedes. I performed 3 dental surgeries on the uninsured. I have the time and a couple of YouTube videos, and I can make this happen for you. And I split my neighbor's cable. So now every single show that I binge watch is a protest against monopoly. Bernie, you complete me. You do. Look into my eyes, Bernie. Look. Look into my eyes. You complete me. You know, it's funny. I wrote, when all is said and done, wokeness will be best remembered for its humor and kindness. And that's not to say some of their gripes aren't real. They very much are. But sometimes you got to pause and laugh a little bit. Life cannot be deathly serious all the time, especially if you're young. For God's sakes, enjoy yourselves a little. There's so many young people who are miserable right now. The earth is not going to end. You're not all going to die, but you are going to live a miserable life if you keep preaching apocalypse. Yes, there are problems, but they're not nearly at the level that that you're at. A very smart guy. I think I've mentioned him on the podcast before. He writes for Bloomberg Opinion. He wrote about a report that came out. Less than 7% of BLM demonstrations included any rioting whatsoever. And I'm like, 7%? Is that a good number? Is that a bad number? I looked at the study. And then it just occurred to me, that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. What percentage of Boston Marathon attendees were violent psychopaths? Two people out of thousands, tens of thousands that showed up, way less than 7%. And what percentage of the passengers on flight 11 and 175 during 9/11, what percentage of them were violent psychopaths? Way less than 7%. A lot of destruction can be caused by a very small number of people. Not only destruction in terms of, you know, what they actually did, but planting the seed and inspiring others to keep doing it and causing general instability. And our Constitution certainly promotes and encourages and makes sure that we can protest things peacefully. But if it's not a peaceful protest and it's violent, that 7% is a big number. Michio Kaku, who's a brilliant researcher and scientist, he talked about how the military is testing these devices that can record our memories and capture our brainwaves. It made me wonder if there's even such a thing as non-military R&D. Because almost anything that you come up with that gives your country or anyone you license a new technology to a competitive advantage, you know, that's a military asset. That is something that benefits your country to the exclusion of others. I've been a fan of public research, but I'm also realistic in that we are a global economy, and it's really important for us to have certain advantages when there are players like China that will cut us out and are doing it in all kinds of manufacturing because they have a monopoly over rare earth metals. Even if we wanted to produce certain electronic parts and computer parts, we couldn't because they have all the minerals that are needed to do it. We do have these international collaborations like Higgs boson, which is that giant collider that they built in Europe, also the International Space Station, and of course, the famous Wuhan Research Center. If you don't know, this is not a conspiracy theory, by the way. This is absolutely 100% true. The facility that supposedly produced this virus, if it produced this virus, where it got released, is a facility that has, I think there's a university in Texas that participates with them, and a whole bunch of other international researchers use a bunch of these labs all around the world to do testing on viruses. And the Wuhan lab is one of them. So that is an international collaboration. Hey, you wanted open collaboration. You didn't want national exclusivity. We got it. We got it. So one infection COVID has prevented is smiling. With masks, smiles aren't infectious anymore. Maybe even laughter is not infectious anymore. And then now people are talking about clear masks. That's only going to make smiling creepy. So I just think it's kind of funny how, you know, we're social creatures, but you introduce this huge impediment into how we socialize. And that itself is going to change our behaviors and society. I mean, when I was a single guy, I mean, picking up girls would be you know, a smile is a way to diffuse, distrust. Because if you're a big guy that towers over somebody and you're in a, you know, bar or club or, you know, who knows, some place where, you know, someone might feel threatened, a smile is disarming. Carrying a Trader Joe's bag is disarming. Walking with your dog or your grandparents is disarming. So there are different ways you can disarm yourself as a single guy. But a big part of it is, you know, the mask. And it's not just for guys, it's for women, it's for, you know, anyone. And I think it's an important part of how we signal whether someone is threatening or not. I know part of it is in the eyes, but I think that that total package is important. And plus, you know, how do you know someone's cute if they're wearing a mask? I mean, this is, we're talking about serious, serious concerns here. Internships. Dianne Feinstein posted a tweet for a clerkship that is a free internship. And there's been a lot of controversy about whether you should pay interns or it's okay to not pay interns. And if you don't pay them, then only rich kids can afford to do it. Realistically, only rich kids can afford to do a lot of things. But I've had the full range. I've had paid, free, and stipend type interns. What's true almost across the board is it's very hard to get employee-like utility out of an intern for a couple of reasons. The duration that they're with you is very short. They're with you for a couple of months, 2, maybe 3 months. By the time you train them, which is a huge, huge commitment of time, and get them doing things the way that you want them to do it, they're gone. And even the best ones, the best, add 40% of the utility that a entry-level employee would, especially over that short time period. So I think the best model, and you know, people can debate this, is some sort of stipend to cover expenses and transport, things like that. But and also depends on the type of company you are. If you're a smaller company, then you have to make up for whatever you're not able to pay in experience or network or recommendations or other things that are intangible benefits, which is something that I try to do and try to get people placed. To me, stipend is probably the way to go. And no one really talks about it because we live in this dumb all or nothing culture where it's like, oh, this is the righteous answer. This is no, listen, experience is worth something. It's worth money. Just like people pay for school, they can learn a lot at a job, especially or an internship that challenges them and not just has them fetch coffee like they do in the fashion and media industries. In 2017, I wrote kind of an open letter to LG, whose phones I was looking at the time, but they had a crappy reputation for not doing software updates on time and basically abandoning their previous customers just to sell the next phone. And they've been struggling. They haven't been making any money, but the quality of the actual devices is good. They're just failing all around, and they were not taking market share. In fact, they were kind of, you know, middling and realistically should have been out of business. But I think some of these Korean companies have so much money that they can afford to sort of, you know, putter on for quite a while. But this is what I suggested a few years ago. And since I suggested this, other companies have started doing this. The first point I made, stop targeting iPhone people. They're never going to buy from you. You're not competing with iPhone. I know you have these, you know, great meetings where you, you know, compare features and all that. Those people are in their own world. And stop imitating their terrible designs. They're not terrible designs for Apple, because if Apple locks you in, if Apple cripples your operating system and slows down your phone, if Apple makes your screen extra brittle so it's easy to break, if they make the batteries, glue them in so you have to replace the phone when the battery runs out and it kind of forces them to do it, you run out of storage, they don't let you use expandable storage, all of these things are great for Apple. And because people are zealots about Apple and the Apple brand, there's nothing you can do. They're like an abusive spouse at this point. They will beat you, they will punch you, and you keep coming back for more. And LG is not in that position. LG can blow on you and you're like, I'm out. Okay, well, especially now with COVID. Focus on the features that you once had that the market still wants. No one is doing a replaceable battery. No one's doing expansion slots anymore. No one's doing really great audio features. Add water resistance, narrower screens, focus on the Android people, because realistically, that's your audience. And you have to update the operating system. Some of these haven't been updated for 9 months. It's not just about security. It's just showing that you care about your customers, that you're not just abandoning them. Hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget, plenty of original, awesome material at patreon.com/McFuture. Tell a friend, tell an enemy. It doesn't matter. Anyway, see you next week. I'm Steve Factor for the McFuture.